For members only, Golf Smarter number 434 and 435, published on April 29, 2014, is brought to you by Harry's. For guys like us who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what we're paying now, go to harrys.com to get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code GOLFSMARTER when you check out. Couple of side notes. Usually the ad would be edited out of the members only episodes, but I have personal reasons why our new sponsor, Harrys.com, is being offered to the entire Golf Smarter community. It'll be obvious why when you hear it. Also, this is 2 weeks worth of episodes delivered at once. The conversation lasted about 90 minutes, but this is a podcast, and you can listen to as much or as little as you want starting right now.
SmarterPodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.
Jim Waldron's keys to putting, confidence and detachment.
This is Golf Smarter.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, Jim.
Thank you, Fred. Great to be back again with you.
It is great to talk to you. I prefer sitting down and eating a meal with you, but not always going to work out.
Yeah. We can make virtual munching sounds.
I think we should avoid the munching sounds.
We can pretend we're in a Thai restaurant, even though we're actually about 1,000 miles apart. But
yeah. Well, we've got to get back together and figure out how we're going to do this. I would love to get together when you in Hawaii. We've done Portland. I would love to do Hawaii, but I don't know.
I'll be there latter part of December until the latter part of March.
So December 2014 to March 2015?
Yeah.
Tell me about, while we're on that, tell me about the schools that you teach and how much you're teaching and what kind of schools that you have when you're in Hawaii.
It's pretty much the same kind of overall type of schools, no matter what the location is. Our most popular is a school called Great Shot, which is 3 8-hour days just on the golf swing fundamentals. We call that our ball striking school. And that has a 4 and a 5 day option. We do an optional 1 day class on the mental game called Rip It to the Target, which is basically a mental focus and pre-shot routine. And like we talked about earlier, how not to focus on the golf ball, how to not become ball bound school.
Yeah, we're going to go into that a little bit later. I'm going to want to talk to you more about that. Yeah.
And then we do a half day of putting as a fifth day. If people want to, because these other 2 days are optional. We do a fifth day on half day of putting and a half day of short game. And when you do all 5 days in a row, we call it the complete golfer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so your schools are in Hawaii and Portland.
Yeah, on Oahu at Ko'olina Golf Club, which is where Michelle just won last week.
Wow.
Congratulations to Michelle.
Congratulations, Michelle.
That's her home course, by the way, her former home course, when she was starting in about, I think, junior high through senior high.
Well, of course she won. I mean, that's not fair.
She played it, not millions, but thousands, probably several hundred times.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But she'd never played well in Hawaii once she became famous in the past. I think because of the pressure of all the family members and, Hawaii is a very, people will maybe not know this if they haven't spent a lot of time there, but it's like even Honolulu, it's like a small town. There really is that sense of family, like a big extended family on the islands. And she was performing in front of hundreds of people that knew her, that she knew them. And so it must have been difficult. I can only imagine, but she used to be right next to us at Ko'olina when we were doing the golf schools, and she'd be right there, like, literally 20 feet away. I'll never forget about 10 years ago, she was practicing hitting wedge shots, sand wedge shots, to put about a flag about 75 yards away. And I'm demonstrating one of the principles, what I call the six laws of club motion, which is forward shaft lean. And I got five guys in the school, and I'm talking, and I'm hitting shots, and I turn around, and they're all watching her. And I go, hey, what's up? What's up, guys? What am I, chopped liver over here? And one guy goes, hey, Jim, she's a much better ball striker than you are. And I go, well, that's true. And the other guy goes, yeah, and she's a lot better looking than you are, too. I go, well, that also is true. So never mind. I guess I am chopped liver. There's a reason for it. Yeah, she was great. It's just a really nice person. I'm just happy that she won. And I think it's going to be a big boost in her confidence. We'll see going forward.
I have to imagine that playing in front of your hometown, it's got to be really distracting.
Oh, it's got to be. Absolutely. Yeah. Huh. Absolutely. You know, it's like playing in high school. Like, you know, you got like a home game versus an away game. And sometimes having the crowd on your side can help, but it's also more pressure, you know. So
yeah, but in high school, you've got the team parents are showing up to every game no matter where they play. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah, exactly. So talk about putting?
I would love to talk about putting with you.
Yeah, we've never done anything on putting.
We've done
maybe our eighth.
Yeah.
Eighth time. Yeah, eighth visit with you.
And why do you think that you beat a man to be talking about putting?
Well, I've been doing putting schools one day, 8 hours of instruction since 1995. And I've told you earlier that we get more positive feedback from students from that school than any other school except for that one-day mental game school. That's the one we get the most positive feedback for. But in terms of the ball striking skills versus the short game skills versus the putting skills, putting gets more positive feedback than the other ones. And I think the reason why is once you understand a little bit about what the basic sort of physical rules of putting are, it you can pretty much start to do them right away, like almost as well as a pro. Whereas golf swing, you know, take a year or two or three or four or five of your life to get to be even like as good as the average club pro at ball striking, right?
Sure. I mean, we've seen guys on tour who tried to change their swing mechanics, and it's taken them years to get back on track.
Yeah, exactly. So putting is so simple by its very nature that we see people dramatically improve. I'm talking about, you know, just, well, I'll give you an example. We had a guy who took putting school last year and went to have a golf vacation right after in North Carolina with his buddies. And his average putts per round before coming to the school were between 36 and 42, which is not good.
That's not good. So wait, is 36 bad, or is it just because he was up to 42? Is 36 bad, or is it just because he was all the way up to 42?
No, I think it's bad, yeah.
So for somebody who's in the 90s, who's shooting in the 90s, how many... You know, so we know they're going to get 18 shots off the tee box, and they're given 36 shots, so that's a 54 already, right? Mm-hmm. And then you've got a couple par fives. So you've got another, 18 shots to make par, but it seems like we were taking 30 or 40 shots in between your drive and getting onto the green.
Yeah.
So, but for somebody who's shooting in the 90s, and I
well,
would think
you,
that's
yeah, if you
most
put it that
golfers,
way, then
right?
I guess I wouldn't say it's terrible. But the point being, if your criteria is what would be a reasonable level of skill to own, if the person knew as much about putting as I know, just in terms of the information, not even in terms of the actual physical execution,
which are two completely different things.
No? What's that?
Are those two completely different things? What you know and how you execute?
Oh, sure, always.
Interesting.
Yeah. Otherwise, the top teachers would be the top players. I'd be out there competing against Tiger. There's lots of things I know I can't do because of my age and because I've got a chronic bad back and because I don't have the same level of talent that a typical tour pro has, right? So that could be a whole other podcast, you know.
Hmm.
There's the old Woody Allen joke from Annie Hall. You know, he said, referring to his high school days with his phys ed teacher.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, the old saying, those who can do and those who can't teach. And then those who can't teach, teach phys ed, teach gym. Which is a great line from anyone.
Or what I've heard of those who can't teach, consult.
Yeah, consult. That's another way of saying it.
All right.
So, there's always the intellectual information about what your mind and body and club should be doing in terms of the ideal, right? And then there's how well are you able to execute it? And some of that depends on your talent level, which is genetic, which you're born with. How much athletic ability do you actually have? Some of it has to do with fitness. Some of it has to do with how much time you're willing to devote to practice, you know, things like that.
But there is a way to become a much better putter.
Yeah, well, let me go back to the example of that guy. So this is a guy who was 36 to around 40, even a little higher. I think 42 was the worst he'd had in the previous year. And he kept stats like you like to do in your game.
Mm-hmm.
And he went out and played Pinehurst. I forget which one. I don't know if it was number one or number two. A few days after the school, he had 22 putts. his first round.
Wow.
He had, I think, 24 or 25 his second round, and he had 26, 27 his third round.
Yeah, but, you know, there's the old statistic about, you know, yeah, he had 22 putts, but he only had, 10 greens in regulation or 5 greens in regulation, so he's doing a lot of up and down.
Sure, some of it's that, too.
Yeah, obviously. He's on the fringe, and that doesn't count as a putt.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely part of it. When anybody, even a tour pro, has that many putts, you know, there's a lot of that going on. Unless they're hitting every approach shot stiff, which that almost never happens, even for a tour pro. So, but the point is that level of improvement is the most I've ever seen, but it's not that far out of the ballpark. People really, really improve once they know some of the basic rules. And, of course, we don't have time in a podcast to cover everything I would present in an 8-hour school.
I'm good at editing.
We were talking about Dave Stockton earlier. And, you know, a lot of my putting stuff I got from Stockton's first book, which was written back, I think, in maybe early 1980s, mid-80s. I can't even remember the name of it.
Unconscious Putting.
No, that's not probably his first book. It was written a long time ago, like 20, 30 years ago.
Oh.
I think it might have been something like Putt Like a Pro or something. I'm vague on the title, but it was his first book at that time. He had some great stuff on putting, and I have seen his new one, relatively new, from a couple of years ago, Unconscious Putting. Let's talk about some of the basic stuff that we cover in the putting class. And
wait, is it called Dave Stockton's Putt to Win, Secrets for Mastering the Other Game?
That's what it was.
Yeah,
that's what it was. Yep.
From August 2002.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a reprint. It was actually published back, I'm guessing, had to be late 80s, early 90s.
Oh, really?
Well, original, yeah.
I'll put that one up in our Golfer's Mart as well. You think it's a good one, huh?
Okay.
Yeah. Well, at the time when he was on tour, he was the number one putter in the world. He could make it from anywhere. Let me just go over some of the stuff, how we present it. I mean, the first thing we tell people is that putting is 95% mental, only 5% physical, which is always kind of surprises people. And I talk a little bit about the history of putting, and there's been a lot of very, very unconventional putting methods that have worked historically in both professional and amateur golf. Probably the best putter ever was a guy named Bobby Locke from South Africa, who had a very unusual stroke by contemporary standards. His feet were only about 4 inches apart. He had a closed stance, which means his right foot was moved back from the toe line by a few inches. And he swung the putter path on the forward stroke in to out with a closing club face, like same kind of path and face angle you try to hit a push draw with in the long game. Now, that's obviously manipulating the putter head, which from a modern theoretical standpoint is never something you'd want to do. But he was able to repeat it, and you know, he believed he hooked his putts. He believed he put right-to-left spin on it, which also wasn't true, but it was a belief in his mind. The basic idea, he found something for him that worked, and he really believed in it, and that's the mental part. You have to, once you find something that works in terms of stroke setup and stroke mechanics and even grip, you really got to start believing that this is almost like magical stuff you're doing, right? Because confidence is one of the really big, there's two I'll call the most important mental game rules. One is confidence, and the other is detachment/perspective. Or what Mo Norman called positive indifference. And that basically means don't be emotionally invested in the outcome of the putt. So detach yourself emotionally from the possibility of either failure or success. And the reason that's important, in fact, I would rank it slightly more important even than confidence.
Oh, that's huge.
There's a lot of,
I love this idea of positive indifference. I know that if I walk onto the course that day going, all right, you're totally confident about your putting, just be confident about it. It changes the way my day is, because I know that if I'm standing over putts going, why aren't they going in, then nothing goes in.
Right. Yeah. That's why if you watch little kids putt, like new golf, people who've been playing, little kids playing golf for maybe a year or two, like, you know, I'm talking like 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old kids, mm-hmm. they make everything. You know, they don't complicate it. It's pretty simple. It's sort of like see ball go into hole. It's almost like that simple, you know. But, you know, by the time people come to take the putting school, usually they're at the putting school because their putting is really terrible, right? And so they've got a set of neuroses on top of some bad physical fundamentals. Hmm. So they've got anxiety, they've got a phobic response to putts, particularly short putts. Some people have it for very long putts. They're doing all these, basically all variations of what we call flinching or yipping is sort of the norm, right? I'm not talking severe yips either. That's a whole other stuff. I'm talking about just sort of mild yips that almost everybody has, for every amateur golfer, especially your high handicap golfer, brings to the putting green.
So, give me an example of what you mean by the yips that everybody has.
Well, the most common thing that people do who are poor putters, by far, there's one very, very common. There's actually several, but the one most common flaw is deceleration of the putter head on the forward stroke. It's mm-hmm. it's like epidemic. Mm-hmm. So people take, they'll have like a, let's say they have a 10-foot putt. And the typical person who takes our putting school, who might be someone who's probably a 15 handicap or higher, right? On a 15-foot putt of medium speed, maybe like a 8 or a 9, between 7 and 9 on the stint meter, kind of medium speed, they'll take it back like, you know, I don't know, 18 and 24 inches on the backstroke, which is way too long. And then their follow-through will be 6 inches. So they'll hit the ball, and the putter will only travel 6 more inches. So massive deceleration. And they'll leave it like, you know, 3 feet short or 4 feet short. That's real, real common. And it just results from, you know, having missed a lot of putts when they first start playing golf and just not getting some of the basic rules, which is if you have a longer putt, you make a bigger stroke. If you have a shorter putt, you make a short stroke, right? And the stroke lengths would be basically, if you're using the modern conventional putting stroke, which is called the pendulum putting stroke, or some people call it the arms and shoulders putting stroke, it's the, almost exclusively what you see when you watch a professional tournament, right? If you're using that technique and there's a ball in place and it's a normal length putt, not a tap-in putt, not a putt that's, say, outside 60, 70 feet, but anywhere from, say, 18 inches to 70 feet long, right? If the ball's there when they're putting, not a practice stroke, it looks and it is pretty much even. So if they take it back 18 inches, they take it through after impact 18 inches, hence the term pendulum, like on a clock, like a grandfather's clock, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what people don't realize is with, except on very fast, short, downhill putts, they're actually adding around 10 to 20% more club head speed on their forward stroke. So it's not a true pendulum motion. There's a little bit of acceleration on the forward stroke. If you watch these guys do practice strokes, non-ball strokes, then their stroke's going to be around 10 to 20% further in space. So if they did a 10-inch backstroke, their finish is going to be 12 inches past where the ball would have
okay.
been. So 2 inches more in space equals about 20% more energy, right? But the ball, when the ball's there, the ball takes up around 10 to 20% of the energy of the stroke when the club head and the ball collide, right? Which does decelerate the stroke a little bit by 10 to 20%. And that hides the fact that they are adding a little bit of acceleration. And so my take is that I think the decel problem has gotten worse since the prevalent use of the arms and shoulder stroke has gotten so much publicity from people watching golf broadcasts that they see that what looks like that sort of smooth, even, you know, looks like they're hardly applying any force. And so again, there's an illusion there. People aren't seeing what's actually happening, right? They're adding a little bit of acceleration. So. Once people understand that, we just have them take practice strokes, and I say add a little more, add a little more, add a little more, until they're at around 20%. Then I tell them, okay, that's it, that's where you want to be. And they're going, well, then I'll hit it too far past the hole. And they will the first few times they try it, right? Because they're still taking too long of a backstroke. Hmm. Then they just learn after a few minutes to take less of a backstroke but still have the acceleration. And there is actually a putting app that works for smartphones. It comes with a cradle that you clip onto your putter to hold your phone. Ping makes it. And the way they have that set up for, this is another way of talking, this is actually another way of talking about putting rhythm, right? Which is the relationship between backstroke speed and forward stroke speed. And the way the app is set up is based on looking at some of the top putters on the PGA Tour. The ideal is a 1.0 second long backstroke and a 0.90 second long forward stroke back to impact with the ball. So that means 10% acceleration, right? So if it's 10% shorter in time, it's 10% faster in speed, right? And it measures how far off you are, or if you're matching that criteria, that standard. After you putt, it tells you what you did. So if you decelled, you might be, 1.5 second backswing because your backswing was too slow and too long, right? And it might be the same. It might be slow. It might be 1.5 or 1.75 coming through. So that would be an example of a decel. And so you just play with this app until you're trying to match as much as possible. 1.0 length backswing, 1.0 second duration of backswing time, and 0.90, just 10% quicker than 1 second back to impact.
I will put a link to the app on the show notes for this show, and it's called an iPing putter app. The iPing putter app. It's only available for iPhones.
Only iPhone, so no Android.
No Android. It's only iPhone and iPod. And then it's a free app, but you can purchase a cradle from the Ping shop.
But, right.
I'll put a link to it. So if anybody wants to,
the only flaw in that device, because smartphones have a certain weight, whatever they are, I'm not sure. I'm guessing what, maybe 3 or 4 ounces or something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've got an Android that's probably at least 3 ounces. That's a fairly significant weight on the shaft of your putter.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't overdo the practice. I would practice with that app just enough to get the kind of baseline understanding of a proper rhythm.
Yeah.
And then then practice without your putter, without the iPhone and the cradle on the shaft of your putter.
Yeah.
It's just going to feel different, right?
Absolutely.
It's going to behave different. Because it's going to be lighter when there's no phone attached to it.
I've tried to hook up my GoPro video camera to my putter to make it look like the ball is being hit. And it definitely adds a lot of weight. It makes it a very different stroke.
Yeah, for sure. So that's the number one flaw. Another one is people flip their wrist, which is common in all shots at golf, all short game shots, all long game shots. If you're a flipper, you tend to flip everywhere, right? And that means the slight angle in the back of your right wrist moves forward, which makes your wrist concave. And that basically makes the club head pass your hands before or even during impact, which adds loft to the putter, makes you hit up on the putter too much, makes the ball hop up in the air too high. It takes a long time to start rolling end over end, and tends to make the face angle change from square to either open or shut. So you hit putts that have really bad distance control and terrible line control because the face angle changes, right, when you flip. So
I don't know why I recognized that early in my when I started playing golf. And I've only been playing for, I've been playing less than 20 years. I recognized early on that if I go left hand low on my putting, my left wrist doesn't break.
Yeah.
I'm able to keep the wrist straight and the back of my hand towards my target.
Yep. And that gets to the next thing that I wanted to talk about, which is we teach that we want our students to have two different putting grips depending on the length of putt.
Oh.
On long putts, we want to have a grip that's, by the nature of the grip, it allows for good feel, for touch, for distance control.
Uh-huh.
And even allows a little bit of wrist action where which I would call hinge, unhinge. But when you unhinge, you don't go past zero. Zero would be whatever angle you started with in the back of your right wrist at setup with the putter at address, which should be with a little tiny bit of forward. I like to see a little bit of forward shaft lean. So I want the butt of the club, the grip end, to be about a quarter of an inch to an inch closer to the target than the putter head itself is. So just a slight leaning forward of the grip end of the putter toward the target at the start. And that'll put a little tiny bit of angle in the back of your right wrist. We call that zero, right? So on very long putts outside, depending on the speed of your greens, but for most people around 60 feet or longer, you're gonna need to add a little bit of hinging of the wrist back and unhinging of the wrist forward as a secondary power source to create more club head speed to make the ball go, say, 75 feet. Otherwise, the rocking of your shoulder girdle, which is the main power source, would be so big and so unwieldy, so clumsy, you wouldn't be able to do it very well, right? And again, the good players, you don't see it much anymore because the greens are so fast in the PGA Tour, but if you look at old TV broadcasts from, say, 20 to 30 years ago, where the greens were much slower speed, and they have a long putt, you'll see it. They all do that motion I'm talking about, right? The slight amount of hinging of the wrist back and unhinging mm-hmm. of the wrist forward. As long as you don't go past zero, it's not a flip, meaning you'll still have a little bit of forward shuffling when you strike the ball.
Well, you can see, when you see old footage of, like, Arnold Palmer, it's like, okay, putting style has really changed.
Yeah, that's called the wristy pop stroke. When he was in his heyday, the greens and the courses those guys played on were probably between 4 and 6 on the stimp meter, really, really slow, and also super grainy because the green mowing equipment back then was like so primitive compared to the current type of technology. Cuts the grass a lot shorter, mm-hmm. right, today than back then. So, in fact, I would say if you played a decent private club today where the greens are super, super short and fast, that the first part of the fringe, the initial fringe that borders the actual putting surface, that's how the greens were back 40, 50 years ago, like putting on the fringe by today's standards.
Wow. So when you're saying that the old days it was like a 4 or 5 on the stimp meter, what are they today on the tour, the stimp meter?
Again, it really depends on whether they're Bermuda or whether they're Poa-Anna or Bent, which are the three main types of grasses. But like the majors, like the Masters, the PGA, the British are a little different, but the Masters, the PGA, and the U.S. Open, particularly the U.S. Open greens, they're up there 12 to 15 really fast, like almost like putting on a billiard table surface, really, really firm and really, really short grass. Bermuda grass tends to be the blades of grass are thicker, so they provide more resistance, even if you cut them short. And there's also the grain effect as well. You have to take into consideration with Bermuda, which if you're putting into the grain in Bermuda, it really slows it down.
Interesting. Do we not see Bermuda on the West Coast? Do we not see Bermuda on the West Coast much? I mean, is it more geographic?
Yeah, Bermuda is mostly the southern U.S. A little bit you'll see some Bermuda, like in Palm Springs or some in the desert there. There's some Bermuda. Bermuda is the grass you use in very hot climates. So like Florida, the South, Texas, Palm Springs, Bermuda. The rest of California is more Poa-Anna and Bent, mm-hmm. particularly Poa-Anna. Mm-hmm. Hawaii is mostly Bermuda or a kind of Bermuda called Pass Palin, which is not as thick a blade of grass and putts a little truer, has much less grain effect. But anyway, back to the grip thing. So the other one is on shorter putts, where the main issue is line control, not distance control. We teach people to do exactly what you're doing. One version, we teach 6 possible short putt grip options, one of which is left hand low. So particularly what I call super short putt range, which is the most important range to be good at, which is from about 2 feet, let's call it 18 inches, just outside tapping range, out to about 6 feet if you play average speed greens. So 18 inches to 6 feet, you need to make those putts. You can't be missing a lot of those and have a decent score.
Or a good attitude.
You're not going to miss those because of poor distance control, right? You're going to miss from 4 feet typically because your line control is poor.
Right.
And if your aim is correct and your green reading skills are decent and you're still consistently missing a lot of putts in that range, you're doing something to change the face angle. So the face angle of the putter is either opening, pointing to the right, or it's closing, pointing to the left, if you're a right-handed golfer. And the reason that happens is because muscle tension creeps into your fingers, your wrists, and your forearms. And that muscle tension, which we call flinching, right,
yep.
makes the face angle change. So, what you can do is use a non-traditional grip, like left-hand low or like the saw, or the paintbrush grip, or the claw, or the Patty Harrington grip, which is what I use.
Which is what? You have to describe it.
I call it Patty Waldron because I do a more extreme version of what Patty Harrington used to do. But it's split hand. So it's left hand low, but my hands are about 1.5 inches apart on the handle. So there's about 1.5 inches gap between my...
Wow.
Between like the palm, the bottom sort of heel pad of my left hand and where my right index finger is. Mm-hmm. There's about 1.5 inches gap. And I have my palm facing, my left palm is rotated 45 degrees to my left, and facing the sky on a 45-degree angle. So it's almost like I'm holding it with my palm facing, well, it's not almost, it is. My palm is facing the sky. So if you were looking at my putting grip from caddy view, from side view, you would see if I open my hand, you would see the palm of my hand.
Okay.
Whereas a normal grip, you wouldn't see the palm of my hand, right?
Because and you don't want that. You don't want your left hand doing that when you're on your full swing either.
Oh God, no! Oh no, you couldn't play.
Yeah.
There's no way. This is complete. This is just for short putts. So, in that particular grip, you could all the short putt grips. I tell my students they can be used well, up to around a maximum of 20 feet from the hole. When you get up around 20 feet or more, you got to go to the standard reverse overlap, sort of standard palms neutral grip, which is your distance control putting grip. And some of my students only do the short putt grip from around 6 feet and in, and when they get to 7 feet, they go to their more standard conventional grip. But the point is, you can learn to grip a putter in a different way that makes it almost impossible to flinch, which means it makes it almost impossible to alter the face angle. And again, if you're not altering the face angle and your path is decent, because path is also an issue, but if your path is in the ballpark and your face angle is staying square to the path, you're going to make a lot of short putts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly as you get older, people start remembering, you know, they've been playing golf for 30, 40, 50 years. There's all these bad memories of missing 3, 4, 5 foot putts in your head, sort of in the back of your mind. And all of a sudden, if you don't deal with that issue, you can end up with a full-blown case of the putting gips, right? So,
sure.
That's the basic philosophy. I tell people, you know, just because you're on the putting surface doesn't mean you should always use the same grip, same ball position, same setup. I bring the example to be logical. I say, think about the rest of your short game. You're probably using, even for a mid-handicap golfer, you're probably changing your ball position, your stance width, how you take it back, the length of your backstroke, the length of your finish, your tempo, how you use your wrists. You're changing a lot. You might even change your grip a little bit. A lot of people use a different type of grip for chipping, for example, compared to their full swing grip. So you're making these changes to fit the shot at hand. But when you're on a putting surface, you walk on a putting surface with the putter in your hand, and you got a 75-foot putt, right, on one hole, and the next hole you got a 2-foot putt. Well, there's nothing in common between a 2-foot putt and a 75-foot putt other than the fact you're standing on the putting surface. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason being, if you're 75 feet away, you're trying not to 3-putt. That's the intention.
Exactly.
Right? Because it's very easy to 3-putt. So what you're really doing is there is almost zero, there's maybe 1% intention on good line control from 75 feet. 99% of your intention is on proper distance control. And conversely, on a 2-foot putt, you're not going to miss it. You're not going to blow a 2-foot putt typically. So, you know, you're not going to hit it so hard it's going to, if it did miss, if you were missing on purpose, you might end up going like, 4 feet by or something. It's just, again, it happens, but not very often, right? Or leave it short for the same reasoning. What people miss 2-foot putts because their line control is poor, right? They hit it to the left or right of their intended line. So why not use a grip that gives you maximum ability to keep the club face square, which is another way of saying good line control, on those shorter putts? And why not use a grip that gives you better touch, better feel in your hands for how big a motion, especially how fast a motion you're making with the putter head? At first I get resistance. People go, it's too. I go, no, it's not complicated. If you spent, just a few hours practicing these two different grips, one of which they already probably tend to have, the conventional grip. Most people come to see me, they have the conventional grip. They're not putting like you are, left hand low, or the claw, or the burn on longer grip, or various other ones. So they already have one of the two. They just have to learn the short putt grip, which a couple hours of practice, people love it, right?
Let's take a little break here now because I want to introduce a new sponsor. I'm very excited about this one, and that's Harrys.com. Jim, are you a blade user or an electric user?
I do both, but lately more blade.
And aren't you frustrated? I know that I'm a blade user, too. I get a better shave with blades and, don't destroy my skin, but I am so frustrated. I am so angry at the companies that make, like Gillette and these companies.
Because they rip you off on the price of the blades, right?
Oh, my God. It's like $4 a blade.
It's ridiculous.
It's like, I don't want to play a Pro V1. I don't want to pay $4 for it, right? I'm not going to pay that much for a ball that I'm going to lose or a blade I'm going to throw away. It's just crazy. And that's why I'm so excited about Harrys.com. You've got to check these guys out. And What they're doing is they've pretty much eliminate the middleman. It's all online. And they even purchased, after doing all this research about blades and stuff, they found a company in a factory in Germany that manufactured really high-end blades, and they bought the company. And it's like a five blade, you know, like the multi blades in one cartridge, you know, it's like five blades, but it's $2 a blade and it's delivered to you. You don't have to, you shop online, and like the first package, which you can get, like they have a Winston and, the Truman, I think are the two blades. And it's just, the difference is, you know, like a real nice stainless steel handle. And that's $25, and that comes with a handle, shave cream, and blades. And then the Truman, I think, is like $15. And you get...
some money.
Yeah, I mean, you're just going to save a lot of money on something you have to spend money on anyway, and you're going to get a high quality... I'm telling you, get a great shave out of it. I know I'm excited to have them as a sponsor, but I've been using Harry's Blades for like 2 years now. Or a year and a half, maybe, because I jumped on it when it was an early company. And so what is really awesome about having them on as a sponsor is that they're offering Golf Smarter listeners $5 off the first purchase. How easy is that, right? Harrys.com. It's H-A-R-R-Y-S. Harrys.com. Put in the checkout code Golf Smarter, and you're going to get $5 off your first purchase. And here's a little invitation from Andy. And I'll tell you why I'm so excited about this. But here's a little invitation from Andy for Golf Smarter listeners to try out Harrys.com.
Hi, this is Andy Katz Mayfield, co-founder of Harrys. My partner Jeff and I started Harrys because we believe that for guys like us who want a great shave for a fraction of what we're paying now, there has to be an alternative. I invite you to go to Harrys.com and see how much money we can save you each year on blades alone. I'd also like to offer you $5 off your first purchase by entering the code GOLFSMARTER when you check out. We've selected GOLFSMARTER because we believe that Fred has grown an active, loyal community of guys just like us. So please go to Harrys.com, that's H-A-R-R-Y-S.com, and make sure to enter the code GOLFSMARTER, one word, and get $5 off your first purchase. You won't believe the savings and you won't believe your shave.
Okay, so... I need to beg forgiveness from the Golf Smarter audience on this one, Jim. But the reason I have, and if you've heard about Harry's on other podcasts or anything like that, you are not going to hear one of the owners come in and make a personal invitation. And the reason I have that is because Andy was just recently at my house. Why? He's my nephew. And so when I heard that they're advertising on podcasts, I'm like, dude, you got to advertise on Golf Smarter. So they said, great, you get one shot. It's like, really? Yeah, we get one episode with Harry's. So I need the Golf Smarter community to jump all over this. Guys, you have to check out Harry's. You got to go to Harrys.com, H-A-R-R-Y-S.com. Check out the site, make an order, use Golf Smarter as your checkout code, and get $5 off your first purchase, which, I mean, it could be like now you're spending $10 and you're getting a month's worth of shaves. That's unheard of. So,
really,
well, okay, so wait a minute. So if it's really my nephew, my niece's husband, does that count as my nephew? I count him as my nephew.
Sure.
Is that okay?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, so everyone, please jump on it today. And there's going to be links in the show notes as well. But it's so easy to remember. And it's even more important that you tell all your friends. You ask them, are you blade or are you electric? If you're blade, if you're not using Harry's, and I recently wrote this on Facebook, if you're not using Harry's, you're stupid. Flat out. Because it's a great shave. They, you know, they eliminate the middleman. They own the company that manufactures the blades now, and they're disrupting this industry. And I'm sure at some point Gillette's going to go, wait a minute, why? Well, screw them. Let's support Harry's, the guys who are coming up and making things different. Harrys.com, and we thank them so much for their support of the Golf Smarter podcast. And good luck, Andy. Thank you for tolerating that. All right, so now do we, is it a logical extension for us to go right into short game, or is there so much to talk about putting that we do this
Oh, I think we should stay on putting.
Really?
Oh, it's a huge. Oh, yeah, there's so much. I mean, think about it. I mean, I'm doing these 8-hour schools. That's a lot of information.
You
know,
yeah.
And not that it's technical, because it's not. But I mean, people need to know what some of the basics are. So that we can keep talking putting. I think it'd be better.
All right. Well, let's continue on with putting, because I think that this is. I know that it can have such a negative impact on my game if I three putt. I carry that with me, and I don't. My mental game has gotten to the point where I feel really good about not carrying bad shots with me. But
right.
If I'm missing short putts or if I'm three putting from 10 feet, it just changes my whole attitude and it wrecks my game and it hurts my score.
Yeah, it's, you know, once I always talk about the, you know, the golf stats like we talked about last time, but and we did earlier today before we got on the air here. But if you're missing putts on a fairly consistent basis from 2 to 6 feet, unless they're very fast downhill breaking putts, because those are hard to make even for the tour pros. But except for that category, if you're missing sort of level putts with just a little bit of break or no break in the 2 to 6 foot range, you're just adding strokes unnecessarily to your score. And it's not that hard. So you really need to focus on that. It's one of the top categories for all skill levels of golfers to focus their practice time. In fact, why don't we talk about that? So here's something people don't realize. The most important putts you should practice, or length of putts you should spend the bulk of your time practicing, are from 2 to 6 feet. You should spend a whole lot of time at home, on the living room carpet, on the practice putting. You really got to be really good at super short putts.
I have one of those short putting mats, those 7-8 foot putting mats. I have one right here in my office, and I highly recommend the one from Skills, SKLZ, because it's got lines from 7 feet, 5 feet, and 3 feet, but it has lines for you to get comfortable of following the line and making sure that you're putting it straight. I love this.
Excellent. Thing. Yeah. Yeah. So in other words, if someone had only a little bit of time to practice putting per week, I would say just practice only from 2 to 6 feet and forget everything else. The second most important distance is long putts starting at around 35 to 45 feet or further, depending on how fast your green. If you play really fast greens, maybe more like 60 feet or further, if you play in a course with big greens to begin with, right? But for most people, it's starting around 35 to 45 feet is where they start getting into three-putt territory because their first putt had really poor distance control. So they're leaving it too far short or they're blowing it by the hole. So the second most important type of putting practice is in that length, around, let's call it 45 feet or out, right? Because otherwise, if you don't practice those, you don't get a good sense of touch for distance control. You're gonna miss hit the first putt so poorly in terms of distance that you're almost inevitably gonna three putt it. So-called lag putting, although I don't like that term because I think you should always picture the ball going in the hole. Why would you miss on purpose? That makes no sense, right?
Well,
from a sports psychology.
So let me ask you that, because you're kind of contradicting what you said earlier, maybe not. But when you're saying always picturing the ball going in the hole, all of a sudden you're putting more pressure on yourself. And not putting with positive indifference.
That's a great question. I'm surprised I don't get that more often. So we have a saying in Balance Point. My company is called Balance Point Golf Schools, right?
Mm-hmm.
We say, here's the saying. We want our students to be mentally engaged at the same time they're emotionally disengaged.
I think we actually, that was the name of one of our episodes in our last conversation when we were eating dinner together.
It was. Now, some people have a hard time in the initial stages of learning how to do both to keep them separate. But over time, you can do that. In fact, eventually, some people can never do it if they use target picture as their mental focal point. So as if someone's thinking about making the putt during the stroke, certain categories of golfers tend to be like this. I'd say about roughly 20% of my students have this problem. If they use target picture as their chosen focal point, which is my term for how you use your conscious mind during the stroke, or during the swing, right, where your mind's attending to is called the focal point. I had a student, I never even knew this, because for me it always worked. I played pretty good golf right away as a kid, and I would just picture my ball going to where I wanted it to go, right, like every other sport. But I had a student who just hit the ball worse than he did normally when he focused on the target. And I found out is that whenever his mind was focusing on the ball going to the target, his emotions became so engaged about the possibility of missing the target,
mm-hmm.
right, that it made him flinch. So if you're that person listening to this podcast, then just picture the ball going to the target in the early stages of your pre-shot routine when you're standing behind the ball, not over the shot, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for people who can disengage emotionally, you can still use target picture. You can still picture the ball going in the hole.
When our conversation with Dave Stockton a few episodes ago, he talked about not taking practice strokes on putting, and I've always been one to do that when I'm lining up my putt and I'm looking behind it and I go to the other side of the hole and I look towards it and then I get over there and I try to get a sense, a feel of how much stroke I need to take on this, right? And take a couple practice swings. So I heard Stockton, and I realized when I'm on the practice putting green before a round, I don't go through all of that, and I have much better distance control.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
So I thought, well, wait a minute. I'm not taking my practice, my practice putting. I'm not taking that out on the course, and I'm paying for it. Maybe I should try to change that. And so recently, I'll go through lining it up and setting my feet and doing all that. I just don't – I trust my instinct more about getting it there than what is it supposed to feel like? What is it supposed to feel like? Which recently what's been happening is I've been coming up 5, 6, 7 feet short with everything, you know, my longer putts obviously, but still coming up short. And so I've stopped doing the practice swing, and it's helped.
You found what worked for you. So this is the last hour and a half of our 8-hour putting class – what you just talked about, where we get more concretely and very detailed in the pre-shot routine, this is what we talk about, and which is, do you want to have a automatic or a non-automatic pre-shot routine? And by that I mean, does your conscious mind need to rehearse the length and speed of stroke, particularly the speed of forward stroke, before you actually walk up and stroke the ball? Or do you just want to walk up and hit the ball and trust your instincts to automatically, unconsciously know, the important word here is unconscious, what the proper distance control is. And you know, the only way you can know for sure is to test both methods, and then whatever one gives you the best results, you stick with that, right? So we call the instinctive way the trust method, and the non-instinctive way, the way we give conscious mind, is we call dialing for distance, right? We call that the rehearsal method.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Most good players use the dial for distance, the rehearsal method. They don't use the Dave Stockton method, which isn't to say that it wouldn't be better for them. Right. It's just that's what you see on TV. You almost will never see a tour pro walk up and not take a practice stroke and stroke the ball.
Right.
Now, there is one guy, the most instinctive putter on the tour. And for a while there, for a few years ago, he was ranked number one in putting. That's Aaron Baddeley, the younger kid from Australia, right? Well, he's not young anymore. I always think of him as being a kid because he's been on tour for, I think, 10 or 12 years now. But he came out. He was really young. I mean, I don't even think he finished college. I could be wrong on that. But what he – and I always use him as an example when I demonstrate this. What he does is he does a totally automatic routine. He stands behind the putt about maybe 5 to 8 feet behind the ball, looking straight down his line. He takes, I forget exactly, I think it's one or two very shortest rehearsal strokes. But I've seen interviews. He's not trying to do that to feel the proper distance because it's always the same. So if he has a 3-foot putt or a 75-foot putt, it's the same length of stroke, the same feet of stroke, right? So the speed's the same, the length's the same. So he's doing it, we call a meaningless gesture. He's just doing this almost like a waggle. He's just making this motion just to be sort of free while he's checking out the line and he's visualizing the ball rolling on the line at the proper speed into the hole. Then he walks up, he puts the putter behind the wall, settles into his setup posture, right? Takes a look at the hole for about 2 seconds. As soon as his head comes back to normal position and his head stops moving, he strokes the putt. So he does no rehearsal strokes dialing it for distance next to the ball or even behind the ball. He's totally instinctive.
Hmm.
When I can putt pretty well both ways, but looking back at my really good putting rounds in the many years I've been playing golf, that it's the instinctive method that works the best for me. But I also know some days it doesn't work at all. So I'll play the first 3 holes. I'll be putting terrible because for whatever reason that day my subconscious mind is not getting its act together, and it's just producing terrible distance control on putts, right? Even though I am trusting it, it's producing the wrong distance. So then I switch to the dialing for distance, the rehearsal method.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to test both to find out which one works for you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure at some point I'm going to go back to it, taking the practice swings. But right now I'm feeling like just go with, you know, what it feels like. Because I know, like, when I was as a kid playing basketball, you know, you just it's totally instinctual, right? When you're running and doing a jump shot, you don't have time to practice.
Yeah.
You know, it's different than a free throw, which I guess a putt
right.
is more like a free throw.
Right.
Well, every golf shot is more like a free throw. But it's just
right.
like you move and you just do it. You look at it and you just know what it feels like to get it to that spot.
Right, right. I mean, you know, if you took a group of six-year-olds and have them roll, and I've actually done this testing years ago, and have them roll balls off their fingertips underhand toward a hole, you know, the first one or two, they'll get the distance a little off, right? They'll be like, you know, from 30 feet, they might be, you know, 5 or 6 feet by or 6 or 7 feet short on the first one or two. And all of a sudden, they'll be rolling them really close to the hole. And we do this drill in the putting class, in the putting school. And, you know, the reason people, after the first or second, if they're still really poor, is because you can see they're thinking too much. How far back does my hand have to go? How far forward and how fast of speed in the forward stroke does my hand have to go? And you can just tell they're not being athletic. And I'll say, Joe, what are you doing? And I'm trying to think about how the – I go, you don't need to think about the defense. That's the whole point of the exercise. Your body and your mind, your subconscious mind, already know how to roll the ball 30 feet without any thought ahead of time. Just trust yourself. And as soon as they let go and trust, they start putting the ball. Sometimes they even hold it out from 30 feet, right? But they're not blowing it by 6 feet, or they're not 6 feet short. They're close to being the right distance when they trust their instincts. So, and that's the most important thing. There's other ways to get to better distance control besides this, but the most important skill for distance control is trusting your instincts. There's no question about it. Even if you're going to use the dial for distance rehearsal method as part of your routine, right? There's people who think they need to rehearse the distance, and if they don't do it, they actually putt. Unless if they do it the way you're doing it, the way Stockton wants you to do it, they're putting worse. It's not that they're putting worse using the instinctive method because it doesn't work. It's because they're not trusting it to work.
Yeah, right.
And so they're getting in their own way. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you understand how the neurophysiology works, the instinctive method is absolutely the best method for everybody. But some people just don't believe in it enough for it to work.
Or trust it. Yeah.
Or trust it, yeah. So for it to work, you have to trust it, right?
Right, right.
There's no question about it. Now, why it doesn't work for me on some days, even when I feel like I am trusting it, I have no clue. But that's just been my experience. But in general, I think if you really get into a state of where you're really letting go, it tends to produce pretty good distance control for pretty much everybody. But again, I think it's just a matter of what you feel confident. If you feel more confident taking a couple rehearsal strokes, right, you're probably going to make a better putt. Now, here's the problem with the main problem with the rehearsal stroke method is, and it's a big one. Let's say normally your average number of strokes is 3 strokes to get the feeling for the proper distance that you want to have, right? So, like, for example, the first stroke, you take it and your feel sense tells you, no, that would have been too short. And the next stroke, it tells you that would have been way too long. And the third stroke, it tells you, yeah, that last stroke is the right distance. Now try to duplicate that, right?
Yeah, right. This is the Goldilocks
problem is,
method.
What if on
right?
your, yeah, yeah. What if on the third stroke you still don't have it?
Right.
You can't keep taking strokes when people are waiting on the tee box back there and you're in a par three. You can't take like 12 strokes trying, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's slow play considerations that make that a bad strategy for a lot of folks. So, because the worst thing you can do is walk up to a putt and not have doubt in your mind.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
If you have doubt in your mind, you are not going to make the odds of you making that putt go down to practically 0%.
Or tension
so
in your jaw.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
Lynn Marriott mentioned that once. When I was talking to her, and she was talking about it, she goes, I was watching Tiger. I knew he was going to miss the putt because I saw how much tension was in his jaw. It's like, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, too much tension anywhere, particularly.
Right.
Putting is not a good thing.
Yeah. But when you said you're thinking too much, You know, thinking too much.
No, it's not. Yeah, it's not.
That's golf. Exactly. Every golf shot, you're thinking too much.
Every shot, not just putting. Yeah. Every shot in golf I teach should come from your subconscious mind. You should never be consciously engaged in trying to make a stroke happen, mm-hmm. or trying to monitor a stroke or influence a stroke. One of my favorite Ben Hogan quotes, which I just heard about for the first time about a year ago, he was referring to his Wednesday Pro-Am partners, who tend to be wealthy, high-handicap golfers, right? Mm-hmm. He said, the biggest difference between those guys and me is they're adding themselves to their swing as their pre-shot routine gets closer to pulling the trigger to start their takeaway. He goes, I'm removing myself from my swing, which is beautiful.
Dig into that. Explain that more. What that means
to you.
Well,
what that means is, you know, and we've all done this. I mean, everybody who's listened to this podcast, and you and I both know, we've had really awful rounds of golf. We play much worse than normal, and we're trying harder, what I call being emotionally engaged. That's mm-hmm. what Hogan called adding yourself. And not even just emotionally, mentally as well. If you're trying to think your way through it with more than one thought or more than one focal point, that's adding yourself too much. A good golf shot, all golf shots, not just putts, requires a feeling of abandonment, of surrender, of letting go of control, of not trying hard, of letting the swing happen, right? I mean, every great player has talked about this. Bobby Jones talked about the release segment of the golf swing as freewheeling, which you can't get any more letting go than that, freewheeling, particularly in the hands, the wrists, the forearms, right? Just letting the club head release, right? So this is a pretty big deal in golf. It's not just in golf. I mean, there's a lot of literature in Asian martial arts tradition that talks about having an empty mind, right? There's a Japanese term. I think it's called mushon, M-U-S-H-O-N, I think is how you spell it, which literally means empty mind. And so, you know, this is all another way of saying you can't literally empty your mind because, you know, you're not a Zen master. You can just sort of go off into the state where your mind is completely still. That's not going to happen. But you can learn to focus your mind on only one thing that's proven to be a good focal point, you know, that strengthens your brain-body connection, not weaken it. And you can learn to deliberately choose to emotionally disengage. And so, for example, we do this exercise. I have people go out and practice not caring on every shot during a practice round, right? And they don't keep score. They don't keep their normal score. What they keep score on is they rate themselves on a scale of 1 to 10 for how little they cared about the outcome of the shot, which is positive indifference, you know, Mo Norman's term, right? And so on every swing, as they finish their swing, they look back and say, okay, now what did I feel in my mind and my emotions on that last swing or that last stroke? Oh, okay, that was a 7. I'll give myself a 7. So about 30% of me was still overly concerned with whether it was going to be a good shot or a bad shot. But the next shot might be a 10 where they hit the feeling is I didn't care whatsoever whether it was a good shot or a bad shot outcome, right? So it totally puts you in the moment, in the process of creating the shot. So it's a really, really big deal in putting. You know, and I mentioned this earlier that the most important fundamentals are mental, not physical, which are confidence and positive indifference. And I always bring up years ago, there was a show on Golf Channel, when Golf Channel first came on cable, hosted by Peter Kessler. It was called Golf Academy Live, and they had Brad Faxon, who at the time was number one putter in the world, with his mental game coach, Dr. Bob Rotella, on. They asked him, Peter said to him, well, let's tell the viewing audience what you and the doc are working on in your putting game. Are you working on path? Are you working on face angle, tempo, grip pressure, aim? You know, all the usual physical fundamentals.
Let me guess what he said. Can I guess?
He said, you can go ahead and tell the audience. You probably know.
Confidence.
No.
Oh.
He said, first they both started laughing, and they said, Fraction said, well, something like, I'm almost embarrassed to say it because it's kind of weird, but I'll tell you, I practiced the art of not caring over the putt.
Mm-hmm.
And they talked about not caring for like 30 minutes.
Mm.
He said, the more I care, the more I tend to flinch a little bit. When you flinch, typically in putting, your grip pressure either tightens or loosens, more typically tightens. When your grip pressure changes even a little bit, let's say the grip pressure in the first joint of your right index finger increases by, say, 5%. That's enough to open the face angle by 1 degree in your putter face. So you got a 2-foot putt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And let's say it's got a little bit of break in it, and you're aiming just inside the right edge. but your face opens by a degree, so it actually hits the right edge and lips out, right? All because that little, that slight increase in grip pressure in one of your 10 fingers. And that grip pressure increase was a direct result of your mind, your emotional side of your mind engaging too much in trying to make the putt, worrying about failure or success. So, you know, Faxon knew this, and so he would practice putting himself into a state of not caring while he was stroking the putt, which is a really, really great thing to practice. And not just in putting, all shots in golf, same thing applies. Right?
I actually have a really interesting example of just that that happened to me a week ago. I was playing with my son, who's getting into playing again. He's actually signed up for some lessons. And he struggles. He is yet to break 100. And he is really struggling, and he beats himself up like crazy. So we got to a point, I think we were like in the eighth hole or something. He's like, all right, what's the wager? You know, he wants to have something to play for. And I said, all right, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to give you not one stroke a hole. I'm going to give you one mulligan a hole. There was nobody behind us, so we were able to do this. I said, I'm going to give you one mulligan a hole. So you have to pick which shot you need to take again, because I'm not going to give you a second chance at a mulligan. You know, if you don't like your drive, but it's, you know, not that far into the rough, or it's in the fairway, but it's short, you may not want to do that because you may want to use it for your putt, or you may, right? So I made him think about which shots, and he had, for the entire back nine, he bogeyed every hole, which he was so excited about that was like great golf for him. And he says, why do you think I did this? I said, because you didn't care as much. I said, because I took the pressure off by letting you know that you could have a second shot if you wanted to. And he was mostly playing his first ball on every hole. He played better than he ever played. And I said, I think it's just because you're not caring as much as you usually do.
Yeah.
You think there's validity to that?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. In fact, the New York Times article I mentioned, they were talking about, you know, they're quoting a number of people, industry leaders, trying to get more people playing golf, because we have fewer people playing golf now than we did 12 years or 14 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We had 30 million regular golfers in 2000. We have 25 million now. And the industry leaders are really kind of freaking out about it, because they're thinking, if this keeps continuing, and people 35 and under are not taking up the game like they used to.
Right. So is this the article that was suggesting the 15-inch hole?
Yeah, that's the article. In the time.
Yeah, everyone was sending it to me.
Yeah, but they also said one of the sort of optional new ways of playing the game were to make it more fun and easier is to have a mulligan a hole. You get one mulligan per hole.
Hmm. That'll slow things down.
Again, but it might create, you know, I guess technically you could say that's going to cause a little more slow play, maybe. But, you know, it would definitely make the game a little more enjoyable for people. But,
well, yeah, and I would say if you do get one mulligan a hole, you're not allowed to go looking for balls that go OB.
Exactly. Yeah,
it's like it's a trade-off. You get one or the other. Yeah. I'll give you a second shot on a hole, but you can't go looking for your ball.
You can't go looking for the ball. But that definitely would cause slow play.
That definitely slows things down.
But I tell people the first thing I tell people is this is the number one thing in putting, the art of not caring. And I tell people the Brad Faxon story.
That's an amazing story.
It's more important than grip. I'd even say it's slightly more important than aim, because I've seen people consistently miss aim to the right or left, and they still make putts if they don't care. I'll give you an example. It's a good friend of mine, Abby's nickname, friend of mine from Oahu. He lives in Oahu year-round. He's the best amateur putter I've ever – he's even better than most pros I play with.
Hmm.
He makes everything, right? And he putts in a very unconventional method he kind of made up on his own. It almost looks like he's chipping. I mean, he rotates his chest a little bit like you would on a chip shot. He uses a belly putter, which, of course, he's got to change that in a little over a year. He looks at the hole, which I also do while he putts. And he shifts his weight from left to right and, you know, from to back to the right foot on the backswing into his left foot, just like you would on a normal shot.
Wow.
But and he typically misaims to the right, but he makes everything, every range. He's incredible, right? But what the hallmark of what he does is, well, he has the confidence, like you mentioned. That's obviously really important. But he doesn't try. He just sort of lets go. So I think that is the number one thing for sure.
So interesting. So
on the physical side, aiming is also something we see people do real poorly. And we test people from around 10 feet. And the typical right-handed putter on a 10-foot straight-in putt, right? We tell them, even if you see some break, I go, don't allow for break. Just putt to the middle of the hole where the little flag stick is standing, you know, sticking straight up out of the hole. Putt like there's no break. And then we measure where they are from behind, right? And they're typically, from 10 feet, the average person's going to be somewhere between 6 and 8 inches to the right of the right edge of the hole.
Mm.
Because the hole is 4 1/4 inches in diameter, so they're basically more like 8 to 10 inches
off the center
to the right from 10 feet, which is terrible, right? I mean, that's another big issue. You've got to learn to aim the putter where you're supposed to be aiming.
Yeah, my last round, I think I had 5 or 6 putts that just lipped the left side. It just kind of it just slipped by the left and then ended up 2 inches past the hole. It's like every time.
Yeah.
It's like, why do I keep doing that?
Yeah, you're probably misaiming. And there's an illusion. One of the
30, I never
one of the
32 misaim,
illusions.
Jim.
You never do?
Never. I never misaim.
Okay. You can buy these little devices. The best way to check it, they're little laser devices that
yeah,
clip
I've seen
on the
these.
Top of your putter, right? And you
yep.
do them in the house against the baseboard of the wall of your living room. And you can see where the red dot actually is. And, you know, there's this common illusion. It's called the parallax illusion, one of the 32 illusions in golf. One of the big ones is the parallax illusion, which is the railroad tracks appearing to get closer together off in the distance.
I thought the number one illusion in golf is that I think I'm good.
Now, that's called delusion.
Oh, sorry.
Different. Yeah. Yeah.
Delusional.
The golfers tend to be self-delusional, right? But that's sort of the good and the bad part of golf is that it allows you to be delusional in both good and, you know, both negative and positive ways. But,
yeah, and play from the back tees with Pro V1s and you're still a 16 handicap.
Yeah, and 40-mile-an-hour wind.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How do you and how do you use visualization in putting? Do you use it and how do you use it? If you do.
Well, first of all, people don't – I think we might talk about this before, but around 5% of the population does not have an internal visual sensory channel, which is – the internal visual channel means you can – either eyes open or closed, doesn't matter. You can fairly clearly or even really clearly picture things in your mind. So if you're that 5% who can't picture, obviously you can't use visualization. Right?
Right.
So those people, they have to use something else. But, you know – There's two schools of thought as far as if you're going to visualize the line, do you visualize it or do you not visualize it? And, even if you can visualize it, should you visualize it? And I've putted well using both. The problem with using visualization is, in my experience working with a lot of people on this, is that oftentimes you just can't do it. So you're standing behind the ball trying to visualize the ball on, say, a yellow line that's maybe, 3 inches wide, going toward the hole with a certain – most putts are breaking putts. It probably has a little curve in it if there's a breaking putt. And you hear you're supposed to visualize it, and you're standing there, and you're looking at it, and you don't see anything in your mind, right? And then what that produces is doubt in your mind because now you failed at the first thing you're trying to do at the beginning of your pre-shot routine. You can't visualize it. So I always tell people, if you can consistently visualize it within 1 to 2 seconds of trying, and it's pretty clear – then add it to your routine. And if you can't, then don't add it to your routine. It's not necessary.
Well, I do use visualization for the path. And I guess this is something I learned from Jeff Mangum on putting. Mm-hmm. But I do visualize what the line is going to be because I have a line on my ball. I put a line around the circumference of the ball. So I can not only get square to my target with that line, I go perpendicular to that line when I lay the ball down, but I also put it in the direction that I want the ball to go, right? So I'm doing that.
Sure.
But I
sure.
also visualize, I look at the hole, I look at the ball, I look at my hole, and I look at the ball. But when I'm going back from the hole to my ball, I follow that path where I think the ball is going to go, but I also visualize the speed.
Correct, yeah.
So that it kind of falls in, it slows down and falls in. But when I'm coming from the hole back, I pick up the speed, the ball speed, as I get closer, my head and my eyes get closer to my club. And when I finally, my eyes rest back on the club, that's when as soon as I get there, I pull the club head back. And I try to keep it at that same speed. So it leaves the club head at that speed and then kind of hopefully drops in the cup around there.
Yeah, yeah.
Am I working
too
hard?
There's one thing people need to realize.
Is that just too much?
Well, the answer is, if it works for you, because there's such a thing about golf. You know, the whole art of golfing well is to go through this exploratory process, either with a teacher like myself or without. Doesn't matter. But you know, obviously, teacher's probably going to save you some time and some frustration. But it's all about the individual self-discovery. That's what's cool about golf, because it presents so many more opportunities for having light bulb moments, you know, really learning and performance breakthroughs than any other sport. There's no other sport that could compare it to golf.
Oh, yeah. No, the epiphany scale.
You find what works for you. And if someone like me goes on a podcast and says, no, you shouldn't do that, don't listen to them. Don't listen to the teacher. Listen to your own experience. If your own experience is telling you that a particular strategy of visualization or feel or a combination of both is producing putts that go in the hole, you'd be crazy to stop doing it.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
You know, you got to go by what works for you. So, but there are some, which isn't to say there aren't some rules that apply to 99.9% of golfers. There are. Here's one. The most important of two issues, which is line control and speed, is clearly speed. I mean, every good putter knows this, amateur and pro. In other words, line control is more of an issue when you're initially standing behind the ball and trying to figure out and read the putt. Once you've made a decision, I want my starting line direction of the ball to be, if I extended it from the ball to the cup, to be 2 inches outside the left edge, if that's where your initial starting line direction is, right? And in your case, it's easier if you're using the line. Then when behind the ball, when you replace your ball on your ball mark, you got the line pointing 2 inches outside the left edge, right? Then the next thing you got to do is when you aim your putter head perpendicular to that line behind the ball as you're setting up, right? Unless you're going to use target picture, including the line on the ground in your mind, as a focal point during the stroke, which is totally optional. You don't have to do that, right? You're done with line control. There's no reason from a physical standpoint. You need to be thinking about the line once you're done aiming the putter behind the ball, right? Because you've already decided where you're aiming it. You already decided the line's going to be 2 inches outside the left edge. You've already aimed the putter there. It's not necessary for your mind to have any focus anymore on the line, zero. But it might be necessary for you, particularly if you tend to have poor distance control, to focus on distance control, right? Does that make any sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because, you know, distance control does affect the line. Obviously, most putts are breaking putts, right? So anytime you got a breaking putt and you choose a particular, you know, theoretically, there's an infinite number. If you want to get really down to the math of it, there's an infinite number of lines that could make the ball go in the hole, or nearly infinite, right? In other words, you could aim 6 inches outside the left edge and putt it at a very slow speed and it could go in, right?
Right.
Or you could aim it maybe even a quarter inch inside the left edge of the hole and putt it firmly at a faster speed and it's going to go in, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in general, when you have a breaking putt, what the general rule is you want to have a particular pace that you use on most of your putts, which I call medium speed. Right, not faster than medium speed, which would be maybe a very long uphill putt, or not slower than medium speed, which would be a fast, short downhill putt, particularly if there's break in it. But again, most of your putts, you want to have the sort of medium speed that the ball approaches the hole, right?
Mm-hmm.
So based on that, whatever you can use your normal medium pace when you're reading a putt to get your initial line, you should do so. And again, probably 90% of the time you can do that. So generally speaking, that means you're not going to be on either extreme. You're not going to be 6 inches outside the left edge. You're not going to be a quarter inch inside the left edge. You're going to be somewhere, you know, an inch or two or three outside the left edge. It's going to be more medium pace, right? But once you pick the line, you've got to commit to it and believe that that is the correct line, even though really what you've just done is guess. Because you don't really know what the correct line is. It's all just guesswork in reality, right? But you've got to believe it's not guesswork. You've got to trick yourself. You've got to tell yourself that ball is going to go on this line that I've chosen, right? That's part of the confidence thing.
Yep.
And then if you then have the proper distance control, which is, I think the distance control is the number one thing in putting. I think it's more important on the physical side than any other physical fundamental, right? Because most people who miss putts that are makeable, they're not hard putts. Or most people who three putt from any distance, it's because their first putt was terrible in distance control, right?
Yeah.
And we can talk more about how you go about achieving that. But that's something that people need to decide. Do I need to, again, back to our earlier conversation, do I need to be consciously focusing on how fast my putter head's moving on the forward stroke or not? Now, if you're using instinctive putting like Dave Stockton recommends, then you don't need to focus on distance control either, because you're letting your subconscious mind be in charge of that, right? So then the question is, well, since you can't switch off your conscious mind, and since a conscious mind that cannot be switched off will tend to wander around and think of things at random, and when it goes on this sort of random wandering mind kind of search, right, you tend to flinch. So what we want to do is we want to kind of corral and control our conscious mind so it doesn't wander off and cause us to flinch anywhere during the stroke. So the question is, what should you focus your mind on? And again, it could be distance control if you're not using the instinctive method. It could be the ball rolling over the rim of the cup into the cup, which is what certainly is the number one reported focal point of great putters, including Tiger Woods. He calls it putting to the picture, right? So you're an internal visual channel. You're in your imagination during the stroke, picturing the ball rolling into the cup, right? If you're going to use a motion picture type of focal point, a moving picture. Or you could just picture the ball sort of on the edge of the cup, about to, like a still photograph in your mind of the ball on the very edge, just starting to fall in, right? That's another way. Another commonly reported focal point is tempo, which is sort of like one on the backswing and then one on the through swing, right?
Yep.
So one, one. A lot of good putters use tempo. Another one is very commonly reported is grip pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Having the proper grip pressure, you know, the proper amount of overall pressure in your fingers at the start, and then see if you can keep your mind in feel channel where you're feeling the pressure in your fingers all the way to the finish of the stroke.
And right? Do you think that these fat grips help that?
The fat grips, the whole purpose of the fat grips is not so much having the proper grip pressure as it is with the fat grip, you're less likely to have a change in your grip pressure. Because anytime you change your grip pressure, like we talked about earlier, the face angle changes.
Uh-huh.
Right? So again, involuntary face angle changes are caused by involuntary finger pressure change or even wrist and forearm muscle changes, which are what is commonly called a yip, or you know, the nicer term for a yip is flinch, right? If you're in the UK or Ireland, they call it the twitches over there, which is more a little more descriptive.
They just get nothing right.
Yeah, but it's
sorry.
I mean, it happens.
Please don't send
every
me emails
day.
About that.
Think about this: every weekend, which is when most people play golf, right? Because they're working during Monday through Friday, all over the globe, pretty much every country in the world, right? Millions of golfers are twitching or flinching or yipping on most of their putts, if not every single one of them, mm-hmm. except for the tap-ins.
Mm-hmm.
That's how common it is. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking severe where, you know, like my friend Dave did. We played a round of golf in Hawaii years ago. He's a really good professional, really good player. He yipped it so bad. He hit a driver 6-iron to 4 feet on about a 450-yard par 4.
And then
really good,
he three-putted.
Right? No, he putted it off the green 60 yards down the fairway.
Come on.
Yes.
How?
That's how bad because his right wrist spasmed so bad.
Oh my
that the
God.
putter jerked about 5 feet in his hands.
How do you not laugh at somebody like that?
Oh yeah, that's severe yips. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
he
putted
it off the green 60 yards down the fairway.
Oh my God. Come on. That's something
yeah,
you see.
Yeah, trust me, there are people listening to this podcast right now that are going to say to themselves, yep, that's me.
Oh, again, I'm so sorry. Oh.
Yeah, I'm not saying every putt, but see, you know, that's what's partly why it's so diabolical. If every putt was like that, you'd quit. Nobody would put
yeah,
up
Yeah, I was
it,
saying,
right?
So is that when you quit the game? Just like, okay,
yeah,
you're done.
Yeah, of course, if it was every
Walk
putt,
away.
Yeah. But that's why it's,
Step
see, that's
away
why
from
it's
the putter.
Even worse, because it happens at random infrequently. I've got a student of mine who has much better now. In fact, he's about 90% cured, but he came to me a year ago in Hawaii with the driver yips. And when he had it bad, that's what happened. His right wrist would suddenly spasm so fast that depending on how he did it, he would either hit a big block slice out of bounds. He's a good player, too. He's about a 4 handicap.
Wow.
Or it would roll, or the face would shut and he'd hit a snap hook.
Hmm.
But he would never know. So it would happen right before the club would strike the ball. he'd have an involuntary massive flinch going on. So, again, when I talk about the twitches or the flinches, I'm talking about a much, much more subtle level of increase in grip pressure. But if you want to putt really well, one of the cardinal rules I really stress in my putting coaching, don't let your grip pressure change. Set the proper amount of grip pressure, which will vary, according to me, depending if it's a short, a long, or a medium putt. So long putts, you want lighter grip pressure because you want a little bit of wrist action, right, for the hinge-on-hinge thing we talked about. In medium putts, which is more about, it's like 50% line control, 50% distance control, you want kind of medium pressure. And I teach very firm pressure for super short putts in the 2 to 6 foot range. Pretty firm, right? Because if you have firm grip pressure, you're less likely for the pressure to change because it's already tight. Mm. So it kind of prevents the yips, right?
Yeah.
Along with the grip itself being, you know, more of a short putt, anti-yip grip to start with. Okay, one other thing I wanted to kind of get off track a little bit earlier, but I wanted to talk about the third category of putts that are important. So first is super short, 2 to 6 feet. Second is long putts outside around 35, 45 feet. What do you think the third putting distance range is? What would you guess in terms of in terms of influence on your score?
Well, it's 2 to 6 feet and 35 feet over?
Yeah.
Yeah, so like the 6 to 10 footer.
Yeah, close. So 7 to 15 feet.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, obviously, once you're outside, once you're around 6 feet, especially for average amateurs, the statistics show you're for an average amateur, you're more likely to miss even a 6 foot putt or 6.5, 7 foot putt than make it. I think it's something like 55% chance you'll miss it, only 45% chance you'll make it.
Hmm.
And that's if it's a non-breaking putt straight in, no break. And as you get further out, as you get closer to the 15 foot mark, it keeps going down. And from 15 feet, I think a good amateur putter might make 3 out of 10. From
right.
15 feet. And I think it's a little more than that for a pro, maybe like 3.5 or 3.95 or something like that.
Well, this book we just discussed last episode or two, Every Shot Counts by Mark
right.
Brody,
he
has very, he has statistics, hardcore statistics about exactly yeah. that. And that's where the
yeah.
strokes gained putting came from.
Exactly, yeah. And so that range, even though the odds are you're going to miss it, which is another reason not to try too hard. If you know you're outside the sort of the must-make range, which is 6 feet or less, right? I define 6 feet or less as even though you're still probably going to miss more six-footers than make
mm-hmm.
by a small percentage, but certainly 5 foot or less. Let's call that the definitely. Again, not downhill breaking putts because those are hard. But if it's you know not super fast, not downhill. And your technique is good, and you use that super short putt grip, you greatly increase your odds of making it. But from the 7 to 15-foot range, you're probably not going to make it, but you can learn to be good from that range and increase your odds of making it. And the reason why that range is important, I call that the birdie putt range. Typically, when you're putting for birdie on any hole, it's in the 7 to 15-foot range.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, I buy that.
Now, you can be putting for birdie further out. I'm talking about makeable birdie.
Yeah.
If you're
yeah.
outside 50... If you're from 16 feet or further out, your odds of making the putt are so low. In other words, the reason let me rephrase this another way. I don't want my students spending hardly any time. In fact, they should probably spend almost zero time practicing any putts from 16 to 35 feet because your odds of three putting from 16 to 35 feet are pretty low if you're decent at putting, if you're not terrible. You're not going to three putt very often from 16 to 35 feet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're also not going to hardly ever one putt from 16 to 35 feet.
Hardly.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. So why practice it? You don't need to practice those putts. You've got only so much time in your life to get good at this game. Strategically, you've got to apportion your practice time, which we've done, I think that was 3 or 4 podcasts ago. We did a whole thing on practice strategies.
Yep.
You've got to take the time you have for practice and maximize your efficiency. So don't practice from 16 to 30, 34, 35 feet. You don't need to. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But practice the third most common, important distance on your list after super short and long are those sort of shortish medium putts in the 7 to 15 foot range. Because usually when you have a chance to make a birdie or even to save par, right? Like let's say short game's not super great, so you're not likely to get, say, within 5 feet or less of the hole when you're chipping or hitting a short pitch around the green or a greenside bunker shot. Let's say the majority of your shots, because you haven't enough time to practice your short game, are going to be from, say, 6 feet or 7 feet to 15 feet. That means to get up and down, you got to increase the odds of making that next putt. So that's why those are important, right? Mm. What else?
I think that this has been an amazing lesson. We've been at it for an hour and a half now.
Wow, it really has.
I'm just blown away of all the information, and I know that we can do another 4.5-5 hours on this, but we're not going to do it today. But I appreciate your time, and I just want to remind everybody, Balance Point, it's balancepointgolf.com, correct?
Balancepointgolf.com. Oh, yeah, and one thing I want to mention, we do have...
Yes, tell me.
We've been doing this for a couple of years now. We have the manuals for all our schools for sale to the general public, including our 210-page ball striking school manual, our short game manual, which includes both short game shots and putting combined. Is also available for sale, and we have the mental games class.
Those for sale. Do the Golf Smarter members get any break on that, or Golf Smarter listeners get any break on the price of that?
Yeah, I think we could do like maybe 10% off.
Okay,
yeah, we could do that. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll work out the details, and I'll give that to the audience after we wrap this up.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Okay,
it's good stuff, good information, and the nice thing again about the putting stuff is you can read the manual and start doing it, right? It's easy to understand.
And what's the name of the manual? Just Balance Point?
We just call it the Short Game Manual. It's a Short Game School Manual.
Okay.
We do a 3-day boot camp. We do the first day Friday is all day on putting, Saturday's all day on chipping and some pitch shots. Sunday is more pitching, greenside bunker shots, and then distance control, you know, partial distance wedge shots. On Sunday, so it's you come for 3 days, Friday through Sunday, you get the whole thing.
Okay, whatever happened to the book? I mean, we did an episode once. You wanted to just start brainstorming about this book, and we one change that we made was it's going to be 18 chapters, not 10.
Yeah, it's a work in progress. I've actually got three books I'm working on. That's one of them.
Okay.
I'm trying to finish up the Arm Swing Illusion book first. That seems to be the one we're getting the most demand for.
Okay.
That's probably going to be, I don't know, it just depends how, I'm so busy, you know how it is, but this summer, if I can find some time away from teaching to sit in front of my computer, I'm about 90% done with that one. So I'm going to try to get that one for sure by fall, by late fall at the latest.
If I can give a testimony to Balance Point, again, it's balancepointgolf.com is Jim's website, his schools in Hawaii and Portland. You should definitely look into it.
And Palm Springs as well.
And Palm Springs, okay. And if I can give one testimony, Jim watched me take 5 swings when we got together in Portland last summer. And I've had a problem forever of on my backswing, my left wrist is cocked. And Jim gave me, and every teacher I've ever worked with or showed my swing to, he said the same thing. Yeah, you got to flatten your left wrist at the top of your swing.
Right.
You know, every single one. They didn't tell me how. They just told me that's what I do. And I've always had a problem with my wrist, whether I'm playing piano or typing or whatever it was, that wrist was always a problem. Jim said, well, just cock your right wrist first and pull back.
Yeah. Yeah, hinge. We call it hinging. Yeah,
hinging.
So the right wrist goes backwards. Yeah,
and it's had such a huge impact on my ball striking. I can't tell you how awesome that tip, that simple tip, was. So thank you.
Yeah, because when you hinge your right wrist back, it makes your left wrist flatten in line with your left forearm.
And now, thanks Fred Shoemaker on awareness. I am very aware of where my left wrist is at the top of my swing, where I never was before.
Yeah, awareness is so important.
Oh, so important.
And I call awareness the supreme fundamental. It's more important than any other fundamental in golf.
And that's what Fred Shoemaker, Extraordinary Golf is all about, is awareness, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, so listen, we're going to have to get together again and do something on short game, or we can keep talking about putting too, because people love hearing this. So again, Jim, thanks again for your time. It was great to talk to you, and I hope to see you again soon.
Thank you, Fred. It's great being a guest again. I love being on your podcast. It's always fun.
And it's always fun for me to talk to Jim. So I did this interview on Friday of last week and then went out on Saturday and played. I actually got a chance to play at Silverado North in Napa, California, where the Fries.com PGA Tour event is going to be played this October. of 2014. I was in a group of 10 guys, and as you can imagine, with preparations underway, the course was playing much harder than the 128 slope that the scorecard suggested. Now, 8 of our guys didn't even break 100. They were struggling so much. The ninth shot 97. But I, you know, getting these podcast lessons, you know, it really feels like I'm getting a lesson every time I have one of these conversations. So between the conversations that I've had with Dave Stockton and Mark Brody recently, and even Jim's advice of detachment or positive indifference, I actually made a putt that was about 6 feet, but it was for birdie. So the pressure was on, and it also awarded me that shot was closest to the pin for the day. And my round, I shot a 43-43. 86 is a good day for me, huh? A reminder to check out the show notes on our blog for links to the iPing putting app and purchasing Jim's Balance Point Golf School manuals. Remember to use the checkout code GOLFSMARTER for that 10% discount on your purchase. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at GolfSmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.